Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP this morning for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Good morning and welcome to For Your Benefit. So, we're here today, November, what is today, 7th, 2011, and we're going to talk about pre-year-end tax planning. Why? We'll talk about that in a second. But joining us is Ed Zerndorfer, certified financial planner, enrolled agent, and we'll get back to what enrolled agent is. It's pretty impressive. Retired Fed and fellow seminar presenter. Good morning, Ed.
Good morning, Bob.
It's good to have you here, and it's just you and I talking about taxes. Now, an enrolled agent, for those of you that don't know, Ed is not an IRS agent, but he took a rigorous test, and I'm a CPA. I used to be an enrolled agent as well, but when I became a CPA, I can't be an enrolled agent. But that was harder than the CPA exam. That was 3 days of intense taxes, and you probably aced it. Do they have the Ed Zerndorfer Award for that?
No, we passed. All I can say is that my initials are E.A. Zerndorfer, so you see the E.A., so maybe it was in God's hands that I was supposed to have been an enrolled agent based on my initials.
Okay, so that's a pretty impressive title. Fed. Ed is also a moderator of Federal Soup. Now, is that a cooking show?
Actually not. It's an online forum run by Federal Employees News Digest. I also write for the Federal Employees News Digest, which is a weekly newsletter, comes out, run by 1105 Media. I write a column every week, Bob, called the Informed Investor Column, in which I try to keep federal employees informed about their benefits, not only taxes, but investing in the TSP. There are other benefits, that they have with CSRS referrers. I write a weekly column, and it's a pretty informative column. That's why it's called the Informed Investor column.
Okay, well, you're going to keep us informed about taxes and investing today. So, Ed, here we are, again, early November, and we're talking about year-end tax planning. Isn't the best tax planning done after December 31st when they do the return?
Interesting you asked the question, Bob, because clients invariably come to me in February and March to get their taxes prepared from the previous year, and they always ask me, Ed, is there anything I can do right now as we speak to save on last year's taxes? And the answer is invariably no, because it's too late, because the real tax planning comes in November and December, because you still have time to do things to reduce your tax liability for the current year, in this case, 2011. So we really have to do things starting now to make sure that we don't get disappointed come tax when we file our 2011 taxes in the spring.
Okay, now the information that we're going to provide between now and the end of the show will provide people the opportunity to understand what it means and to understand the things that they may be entitled to. But if somebody steps back and looks at what they're paying, I think tax planning makes that much more of a difference. And without putting anyone to sleep, but let's say that most people listening to the show are either working or they're a federal retiree. Most likely they're paying tax at a 25% federal bracket. We'll talk about that in a while. And they may or may not have state taxes, but let's say that that's 5% just for the sake of discussion to get us going. So that means for every dollar that they can come up with a legitimate tax deduction, they'll save 30 cents. For every $100, they'll save $30. For every $1,000, they'll save $300. So this is not an insignificant exercise because the savings are nice. So let's get into it. We'll talk about brackets later, but I find sometimes when talking about tax brackets, it's just too busy. Currently, we're in a transition period, I guess you'd say, that the quote Bush tax cut, end of quote, have somewhat of a short life that are going to go away at the end of 2012, most likely, maybe not in total, but certainly some of them. And there are some things that are going away at the end of 2011, not necessarily the Bush tax cuts. So if we were to look at then why this is attractive, one of the things, if I'm not mistaken, is that's going to go away is the deduction for state and local sales tax. Now, those of you all in metropolitan areas, pay no attention to what I just said. What we're talking about are the sales tax deductions available to people in very, very, very low income tax states or states that don't have a state tax return. Now, people can get that deduction. Some of us can remember that deduction from many years ago, prior to 1986. They could get it on virtually anything that they paid sales taxes on and the like. So that's going to go away unless Congress decides to extend it, but they don't appear to be in a tax savings extension mode.
That's very well, that very well may be, but somehow it's been my experience, Bob, over the last couple of years that things are done at the last minute, like December. Congress will have a tendency to put things off, and I guess the good news is there's no election this year. There's no congressional elections. There's no there's no presidential election. That'll be next year. So It's a good possibility Congress may do something between now and the end of December, and I think that my feeling is I think they're going to keep the sales tax deduction. That's just my gut feeling. My crystal ball has been broken for years, but since it's been around for the last couple of years, I think it's a good chance Congress will renew the sales tax deduction. I guess the last time we had when it came about back, I think it was 2004. We have to remember that. Both the president, President George W. Bush, and Vice President Cheney came from states that had no state income taxes, Texas and Wyoming. So I guess that was one of the incentives back then.
I didn't know that. I knew President Bush did, but I didn't know. Anyway, so we got sales tax issue. So should people run out and buy clothes? No, because the cost benefit isn't there. But maybe if they were looking at buying a larger ticket item in 2012, if they could accelerate that into 2011, no one should go out and spend the money just to spend the money, but certainly it would bring the deduction where it is clear that they get it, where it might be unclear that they would otherwise. This is another small deduction, and it's probably not for, again, the listening federal public, but if somebody happens to know somebody, spouse or otherwise, that's a teacher and spends money in class and doesn't get reimbursed, budgets being tighter and tighter with state and county expenditures, that they can claim a it's not even a deduction. It's called an adjustment, which is better than a deduction, just right off the top of your income of up to $250. Again, not a big deal, but if you had spent it and were unaware of it, you know, you might be talking about saving $75. There's another thing in here, and for a while, to be frank, I had a little trouble with this. What difference does it make if somebody donates money directly out of an IRA to a charity? In other words, they don't take the money out, put the money in their account, and then write a check to the charity. They can just transfer the money out of the IRA. And somebody explained it to me, it was probably you, Ed, and said, Bob, if it never hits the tax return, it just goes out of the IRA that would otherwise be taxable, and it goes to the charity that would otherwise be deductible. It's not deductible, and it's not included as income, but I missed the point that some people that are retired receive Social Security. And if they receive Social Security, it's taxable based on the size of their income. If their income included an IRA distribution that they then wrote a check to the charity, it could cost them tax money. Is that right?
That's right, Bob. And I think we are really talking about people who are over the age of 70 and a half, who have to take money out of their traditional IRAs. They're the ones who are most affected by this, because most of those people, are on Social Security, so they have to be concerned about paying taxes under Social Security. So this might be one way of offsetting the tax they have to pay on their Social Security benefit.
Sure. And it could be for somebody younger than that, because they just took it out to live on anyway, but if they were going to give it away, they really weren't going to live on it. Or they were going to take it out, make a special donation, whatever. It would seem to make some sense to heed that potential being phased out. Tax credits. Extension of expanded dependent care credit. What's a dependent care credit? You mean you get credit for raising your kids?
I think it's up to a $1,000 tax credit for raising a child who is younger than the age of 17. Because apparently that's what Congress had felt was the average cost to raise a child from the age of 17, $1,000 of your tax dollars would be enough, and that is a tax credit that is sensitive to your adjusted gross income. So those people who have children below the age of 17, just by the mere fact of raising those children, are able to deduct from their tax liability up to $1,000. But again, they have to be below the adjusted gross amount for the year, the limit. That may not be extended as well.
I don't want to make this sound like a commercial, but your comment just now shows how hard it is to do a tax return from scratch. In other words, by hand. It's just hard. I'm not being a commercial for TurboTax or MacinTax or TaxCut or whatever it is, but I would urge people to do that. Certainly, if it gets beyond that, they might seek the help of a tax professional like yourself or myself. But this should not sound self-serving. It's just that complicated. At a minimum, they ought to look at a computer program to do it at a minimum. No, you can't ask it questions, but it can make computations that would make your hair hurt if you tried to do it yourself.
Most of these programs, like you mentioned, TurboTax for one. TurboTax is one of several good programs out there. I've been very impressed, not that I use these programs, but I know the people that I talk to who use them are very impressed by it. The programs do, in fact, ask many times relevant questions in order to avoid future problems down the line.
Right.
Let me give you one example. The TurboTax asked a question, did you contribute to an IRA for the year, an individual retirement arrangement? And then if you say yes, the program says, are you covered by a pension plan? And from that, the program, based on your income, can determine if you can do a deductible traditional IRA, if you're eligible for that. You're always eligible to do a non-deductible traditional IRA, but the deductible traditional IRAs have income limitations. If you're covered by a pension plan, that's where the program will determine what type of IRA you're eligible to do. So the TurboTax does ask good questions.
Yeah. And if you all want to ask good questions, Ed and I are here to answer them. 202-465-3080. 202-465-3080. It is 10:18. It is November 7th, 2011. We will be here till 10:58, maybe 10:59. Don't call us afterwards because we won't be here. We'll give you an email later. But again, 202-465-3080, and we can, I bet, answer most any question you give us on individual taxes and maybe even corporate taxes. But let's try to keep it to individual. Payroll tax. There was a payroll tax holiday. I won't say it's a payroll tax. It was a decent-sized savings on FICA tax, but that's scheduled to go away at the end of this year, no?
Yes, Bob. The FICA tax, the Federal Insurance Contribution Act, or Social Security tax for employees, was reduced from 6.2% to 4.2% during calendar year 2011. It's scheduled to go back up to 6.2% in the year 2012, the first pay date in 2012, again, unless Congress extends it. But right now, it's hard to say what Congress intends to do. So right now, we have to assume it's going to go back to what it was before.
Okay, now that also means something to the listening public. Maybe it's going away, but you know what then is going to go down? Your take-home pay.
Take-home pay.
So if it goes back up, we're going to have less in our paycheck. Capital gains and losses. People talk about, well, you know, I wish I had claimed a loss. I bought some stock or I bought something and it went down. Ed, if you sell an asset, a stock, a mutual fund that's gone down after you bought it, whenever you bought it, and you sell it before the end of the year, would you be able to claim the loss on that transaction?
We're talking about a capital loss here, Bob.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Stock or mutual fund.
Okay, if you own a capital asset, a stock, a bond, a mutual fund, that you've owned, or maybe you inherited it. You could have inherited it, or somebody may have gifted it to you, okay? Depending on what your cost basis is.
What you paid for.
What you paid for it, or whatever the other person paid for it.
Or the value of the day the person died.
And if you sell it, then you might be able to claim a capital loss if it's gone down in value, okay? On the other hand, if it's gone up in value, you're going to have a capital gain that you'll have to pay a tax on. However, there is a so-called preferential tax on capital gains. which may be to your benefit too, because you'll pay less tax on a capital gain on something that you've held for at least 1 year, compared to the interest that the tax you'll pay on the interest that you get at the bank, or your salary, or your pension income. So this is called the preferential tax rate.
So you probably would not want to then sell an asset that you've held for less than a year to offset the capital gains you may have made in a mutual fund or elsewhere, because you're burning up dollars that would otherwise be 100% deductible against 15% taxable.
Well, if you sell something at a loss that you on a capital asset you've held less than a year, then you're going to pay the rate on that would be, again, the same. You'd be offsetting salary income, interest income. We're talking about things you've held for more than a year.
Right, but you wouldn't sell a short-term asset to extinguish the gain from a long-term asset.
If you have no long-term capital gains.
Oh, if you have no long-term capital gains, it's easy.
Yes, yeah. Then you can do it. But again, the rule is you have to offset long-term capital gains with long-term capital losses, and short-term capital gains with short-term capital losses. But if you don't have one, then the other will offset the other.
Okay. Could we take a little detour here, and let's not dig too deep into it, the alternative minimum tax. People in class say, could you explain that? And I go, there isn't enough time today. But the alternative minimum tax, just help me, and then you can fill in the heavy-duty stuff. It's an alternative way to get more tax, designed many, many years ago to tax the wealthy, if you will, so that they would pay a minimum tax. Unfortunately, it's never really been changed that much so that more and more people that are anything but wealthy might be hit with it, middle-income types, maybe even high or low-middle-income types. But I think it works like this, that you take your regular tax, your regular income, and you put it over in column A, and then in column B, you go, okay, in column B, you can't do certain things that you could have done in column A. You can't deduct state and local income tax. You can't deduct real estate taxes. And that doesn't show up in B. And then they calculate the tax from the adjusted income differently than they did when you did your normal return. And at the end of the analysis, they say, which column is higher? Whichever column is higher, that's the tax that you'll pay. You'll never pay anything lower under the alternative. Is that the way it works in simplistic theory?
Yes, Bob. It's a parallel tax, and you have to run them together. And again, I can't think of any programs tax programs that don't do this. Like TurboTax runs a parallel computation. I think it does it automatically to compare what the regular tax is and what the AMT is, and whatever comes out higher is the tax that you pay.
Okay. And so for what we're saying, for those listening, in your year-end tax planning, we gave you specifics, but this is a specific. But if you are using a computer or using a tax preparer, you might say, okay, this is what I've got this year. Where do I stand with regards to the alt min if they got nipped with it last year? Or where do I stand if I do X, Y, or Z before the end of the year? Does it make any sense for me to do it? And this is serious tax planning without being over-the-top complex.
I mean, there's certain things that are going to trigger the AMT, one of which is you have a lot of mortgage interest you're paying. You're paying a lot in state and local taxes. So this is where it invites for some planning that if you were thinking about prepaying your January mortgage in December, and you think you might be close, you might be subject to the AMT, maybe you shouldn't do it. If you pay estimated state and local taxes, the fourth payment is due actually January 15th, and you're thinking about, well, maybe I'll pay it in December. This way I'm able to deduct the estimated state tax payment on my federal taxes for this year, 2011. By paying it in December, you shouldn't do it, because you can end up triggering the AMT by prepaying these things in December versus waiting till January.
Okay. Now, with regards to selling an asset and generating a capital gain and maybe getting the lower tax bracket, if somebody was to donate that same stock to a charity, would they get a higher deduction than they would with regards to paying the lower tax? Would I be happier getting a 30% tax deduction rather than paying a 20% tax?
You have to run the numbers, but generally speaking, that if you something has gone up in value, like a stock or a mutual fund that you donate to a charity, you get a deduction. Whereas something that's going down in value, you're better off selling, taking the capital loss, and then taking the cash that you get from selling it and donating it to the charity. This way you sort of get a double deduction.
That's where I was going. Okay. Retirement plans. I mean, probably most, if not all, people listening to the show have heard this plan called the Thrift Savings Plan. If one had not fully funded it by year's end, and again, we're early November, is there an ability to jack up the amount that's going into the TSP between now and the end of the year if we have the cash flow to do it? And this is all very nice to talk about, but if we don't have the cash flow to do it, we can't do it.
Bob, you know how many seminars I do. I average 3 to 5 a week, it seems like. And during these seminars, I am shocked by the lack of understanding regarding the thrift savings plan. I'm still having people come up to me saying, you know, Ed, I really would love to put more money into the TSP, but I have to wait for the next TSP open season. There is no such thing as an open season anymore. They went away 5 years ago. An employee can join the TSP at any time. They can increase their contribution to the TSP at any time, which means that for 2011, you have until your final pay date in December, whenever that may be. Notice I said pay date, not I didn't say pay period, because pay period 26 this year at most agency ends on December 31st. You're going to get paid for that in January if you're an employee. You can't use that pay date in January for this year's TSP, so you have to figure out how many more pay dates I have left this year in 2011. And how much can you put in for the 2011? The regular contributions are $16,500. And if you're 50 or older as of December 31st, 2011, you can put an extra $5,500 catch-up contribution in. So that makes a total of $22,000 if you're 50 or older as of the end of the year. So it's a good idea for employees to look at their most recent statement of earnings and leave and see year-to-date how much money they put into the TSP and figure out how much they can reasonably afford to put in from now until December 31st and make the move now to increase the contribution.
Okay, thanks. There's another retirement plan out there. It's a strain of an IRA, and as Ed mentioned before, most of us call that individual retirement account. It's really an individual retirement arrangement, but it's like potato and patata. Nonetheless, somebody can put money into it, and they go, yes, but didn't you just say I could put in $22,000 into the thrift? What do you think, I made of money? But let's say that somebody is fortunate enough to still have some money left over. They can put money into an IRA. And as Ed said, it's immaterial. You can always put money into an IRA if you have earned income. And you better have earned income if you have money going into the thrift. But this Roth IRA thing is available, and it's pretty much, correct me if I'm wrong now, I'll just kind of lay it out. You put money into one of these IRA things, depending on your age, it could be $5,000 or $6,000, depending on your income, it may be deductible, it may be not, but nonetheless, you could do it. But they come in two flavors. One is called a traditional IRA that's been with us since 1975. And then they have this new thing, it's not real new, Roth IRA that came out in 1997. And in theory, you could take the same amount, put it in the same investment, and before you took it out, after a number of years, it would be worth exactly the same amount, assuming there was no tax deduction going in. But when you took the money out of the IRA, there was absolutely no income, a Roth IRA, there was absolutely no income tax on the earnings, but on the traditional, there would be tax on the earnings, somehow prorated over what was in there. Is that a fair summary?
That's a fair summary, and I think what we're talking about here, Bob, is one of my favorite subjects. It's called tax diversification. We just mentioned about the TSP. You mentioned that the TSP contributions that you make via salary deduction, it comes off your gross salary, so you're getting a federal, in most cases, a state tax deduction by income tax deduction by contributing to the TSP. So that's what I call tax deductible. It reduces your gross salary. That in turn means you pay less in federal and state taxes for the year. The next type of tax savings comes from what I call tax-free, meaning that when you pull the money out of it, you don't pay any tax at all. And that's exactly what you mentioned with the Roth IRA. When you put money into the Roth IRA, you use after-tax dollars. But the money comes out of a Roth IRA. I should say when you make a qualified distribution from a Roth IRA, all the money coming out, both your contributions, which are already taxed, and earnings aren't taxed. And then the other type of tax savings we talked about a few moments ago, the so-called tax preferential rates of 15%. So those are the three ways we can save on taxes: tax deductible, tax free, and tax preferential rates.
Okay. There's also a provision that people can transfer traditional IRAs into Roth IRAs. And several years ago, that was not so easy, depending on the size of somebody's income. Income's really not a factor now, but taxes potentially are. If one was to transfer traditional IRAs that have been around for a while, hopefully they have some profit in them. But they would have to pay taxes on that profit all at once, but not at the low capital gains rate, but at the normal high rates. And maybe somebody did this earlier in 2011, figuring, I wish I'd done it in 2010, but it didn't. So they did it in earlier 2011. But maybe at this stage, as we speak, the value of that asset has dropped. So in other words, they would have taken a higher valued asset in earlier 2011, moved it into a Roth, and are going to be paying taxes on it come April 15th next year, but it's gone down in value. That's kind of like a double hurt. First of all, you have to pay taxes to move it over, I understand that. But now we're going to pay taxes on phantom income because it's not there anymore. There's some old Seinfeld episodes where if somebody did something, they got what was called a do-over. All right? Now, in the IRS world and the IRS code, they don't have the word do-over, but they make it a multi-syllable word, recharacterization, which is akin to a do-over. So if I transferred money from my traditional IRA that would otherwise subject me to some taxes, I have the provision to do a do-over, but let's call it what it is, a recharacterization, and says, 1,000 pardons, I meant to do this, but not if it was going to go down. Am I entitled to move it back into the traditional IRA and pretend it never happened? Is it that simplistic?
It's along those lines, Bob. And the wonderful part about recharacterizing an IRA is the fact that many people, when they see their tax bill, they say, well, I guess I can afford that. But then they did this earlier in the year, but now it's towards the end of the year. They're facing a big tax liability come April 15th. And they say, I don't know if I have the money. And now I really kick myself for doing it in the first place. They have a chance to say, okay, let's forget the whole thing. All is forgotten. No tax bill. It's a good opportunity. And I just want to say this. This has been a real roller coaster in the stock market this year. Individuals who put money into IRAs, they're invested in the stock market, stock mutual funds, have seen a real roller coaster with their investments. And this gives them an opportunity to sort of play Monday morning quarterback. Well, I shouldn't have done this. Now you can play Monday morning quarterback and undo the damage, so to speak. I also want to point out that the IRS has given us another gift, that if you open up a Roth IRA, do a conversion, then change your mind, recharacterize it, and then change your mind, you actually can come back and you can reconvert it, provided you follow the rules. There are some specific rules, but you can end up reconverting again. So now you can go back to where you first started.
Now, is there a time limit on the do-over? I have to do things simple. The recharacterization. Isn't there up until October 15th of the following year that you did it? So, I mean, you got a long time to make up your mind.
In other words, anybody who converted a traditional IRA to Roth IRA in 2011 has until October 15th, 2012 to actually recharacterize. That is a nice amount of time.
Yeah, and like you say, it can be a ping-pong match depending on – and then you can put it back in the Roth after, like you say, a certain very strict period of time, which isn't particularly long if you're looking at October 15th.
That's correct. But, Bob, I always advise clients, don't do any of this conversion recharacterization until you talk to an accountant who understands all the rules, because you can end up shooting yourself in the foot. Be very careful with that.
Especially the voluntary contribution program.
Exactly.
Which we have a whole show on, and it's archived on this website, NITPINC.com, and it's the July 11th show. I don't think we need to go a whole lot into that today. That's a whole show in and of itself. Ed, I read this stuff every year, and everything seems to be indexed to inflation except people's salaries. All righty. So we have tax brackets, and they're indexed to inflation, and people go, what are you talking about? Let's say that a tax rate ranged from a certain dollar amount to another dollar amount, depending on how you file your tax return. Let's leave that alone. But that number for 2011 will not be the same in 2012. But look at the good side. The 2012 numbers are going to be at a lower rate because they've been, quote, indexed to inflation. Now, it's not gigantic, but whatever they take, we'll take it. So, in other words, the tax bracket for a lower amount will be capped off at a higher amount in 2011 than what it was in 2012. So in doing some of this year-end tax planning, if they are sensitive to a rate change, be aware that maybe it's better to do whatever you're going to do in 2011 because you'll get more bang for the buck than what you will in 2012.
This is very important for employees, Bob, who are planning to retire on December 31st, 2011. This is what I point out in class when I do the benefit seminars, that people ask me, what is a good day to retire this year in 2011? And that's going to be December 31st because it's the end of pay period 26. And you can build up the most amount of unused annual leave and get paid for it, and you'll get paid for it in 2012. But you got to be careful because all this money will be being paid out in 2012. And if it's a substantial amount of unused annual leave, it could, in fact, push you into a higher tax bracket because annual leave is considered to be earned income, and it will be added to your other income that you receive in 2012. And people have to be prepared for that.
All right. I had an interesting conversation with a friend of mine not long ago, a week or two ago. And they were looking at retiring in November. There isn't much left in November, or at the latest, November 30th. Mm-hmm. And they had substantial accumulated leave. They're a FERS individual. And they said, I'm already at the cap of Social Security. If I get the accumulated leave in the current year, I won't pay any Social Security taxes on it. But if I wait till December 31st, which, like you say, is a very attractive date, I'm going to pay an extra 6.5% in Social Security taxes on that accumulated leave because I'm not going to have any other earned income. They weren't going off to a second career. And I thought it was an interesting comment that it even trumped if they got some of that into a higher bracket, because now we got a full year's worth of salary, accumulated leave on top of it, but their tax bracket wouldn't change 6.5%.
Well, this question invariably comes up about people retiring November 30th versus December 31st, and you're right that if you've reached the cap in Social Security wage base, which in 2011 is $106,800, you could save this year the 4.2%. payroll tax next year probably go up to 6.2%. However, you got to weigh the fact that if you retire December 31st, all the income will be paid out in 2012, and versus having it all paid out in 2011. And having it all paid out in 2011, keep in mind, and that's we're talking about December 2011, that with an excessive amount of unused annual leave, that could push you into a higher bracket, a higher marginal tax bracket, let's say 28%, maybe 30%. So you might be saving the 6.2%, but you're going to pay for it in terms of going from a 25% tax up to to maybe as much as 35%, which is the highest bracket. So you're going to end up paying 10% more in taxes. Taxes.
All right. So there was, I enjoyed the conversation and I enjoyed your interpretation too, because if it's sizable enough, it could go higher than the 6.2%.
Also, want to mention that because the unused annual leave, the lump sum payment for unused annual leave, If somebody retires December 31st, the unused annual leave will be paid to the individual in January. Unused annual leave is considered to be earned income, which means the person will be receiving a W-2 for the – if the person retires December 31st, 2011, will get a W-2 for the year 2012 showing the unused annual leave, which could make that person eligible for MITE, for a deductible traditional IRA, which could offset some more tax
and
for 2012.
A Roth IRA.
Or a Roth IRA, which there wouldn't be upfront tax savings. But remember, in order to contribute to any type of IRA, traditional Roth, you or your spouse has to have earned income.
Okay.
And unused annual leave is considered to be earned income.
Right. And there was a bill floating around Congress about this time last year. I understand it's been given some new, quote, life, but it probably doesn't have enough power to get to the finish line to allow people to put money into their TSP from the accumulated leave. Now, nobody should mishear that. That's not a provision. I don't know that it ever will be a provision, but people float bills in Congress if for no other reason that they're in maybe a highly populated federal employee state.
You're right, Bob. The only thing under current law, a retiring employee's last opportunity to contribute to the TSP would be their final paycheck. And they could, in fact, put most if not all, of their final paycheck. Not they could put most of their final paycheck into the TSP. They'd have to leave room for health insurance premiums, Social Security taxes, Medicare Part A, their FERS or CSRS contribution, but the rest of that check could go into the TSP, and that also will now result in more tax savings in this new calendar year because the contributions to the TSP offsets their income.
That's true, and I remind people in class, and I'm sure you do too, if you're going to try to kind of front-load, get a lot of money into the thrift at the end of the year or at the beginning of the year, if they're only going to work during the year because they're retiring, that they needn't have any federal or state taxes withheld on the dollar amount that's going in there. So that's more that can go in there. That's kind of crazy to withhold taxes on money that's not taxable. But it provides more of a tax shelter for them.
You're right, Bob. And since we're talking about the Thrift Savings Plan, we might as well mention that the contribution limits for the TSP will go up in 2012 for the regular contributions. For 2011, the most all employees can put into the TSP, what I call the regular contributions, not the catch-up contributions, the regular contributions, is $16,500, and that will increase to $17,000 in 2012. And employees probably in mid to late December should start thinking about how much they want to put in for 2012, especially FERS employees, in order to get the maximum match. For the year, they must be putting in at least 5% of their gross pay each pay date to get the maximum match of 4% for the year. So probably in mid to late December, they should go online to the TSP website because the TSP actually has a worksheet to for employees to figure out what is the best way to put the money in for the year.
Okay. Now, this show is being brought to you by NITP. And we're a retirement, mid-career, beginning career, answer any question you have, company, along with Ed Zirndorf. Of course, he runs FedSoup. That really doesn't have anything to do with NITP, but it's, you know, you can go in there and get a lot of questions answered. But, Ed, how does somebody contact you? You know, we've given plugs for people to call, but nobody's called. And you always answer your phone.
Well, the best place, if you have questions you want to ask to me, and as you mentioned, Bob, I'm a seminar speaker for NITP. I teach the benefits. I teach financial planning. I teach tax planning on behalf of NITP. But if individuals have questions about anything regarding their benefits, financial planning, tax planning, the best place to send your question is the website www.federalsoup, that's one word, federalsoup.com. This website is run by Federal Employees News Digest, and one of the aspects to the website are questions and answers that I've been answering. I've been doing this now for over 10 years, and they've actually archived all the questions that have been generated over the past 10 years with the answers. And you can ask me anything regarding benefits, TSP, taxes, estate planning. I answer questions many times about that. And I'll be there's no limit as far as how many questions you can send me.
Okay. That's how you can get in touch with Ed. All righty, Ed, we're back now. We're looking at the tax return. The federal, there's a federal gift, and people sometimes think that a gift is a charitable donation. What we're not talking about here is not a charitable deduction, but rather a gift that one could give to somebody other than a charity. That's always going to be deductible. But let's say that we wanted to give a gift to our friend for friendship. We wanted to give a gift to a child because they needed money. We wanted to get it out of our estate. But that's a lot of money that they can do. They can gift up to $13,000, although I always intend to be a little cautious here. And I said make it $12,500 because holiday presents as well as birthday presents count in the gift calculation. And, you know, for the really by the books, I don't want to be near the gray type. They like that. For the other ones, they go, okay, whatever. But I think I understand why you can't deduct it, because it isn't going to a charity. It's going, and somebody said, well, you know, my kids are my charities. Well, they're not recognized charities. They may or may not be, and I say that facetiously because I'm sure all children are very good children rather than charities. But it is also good estate planning. You brought up that comment about estate planning. This would reduce one's assets that might otherwise be subject to maybe an estate tax. Might be a little harder for a federal gift tax, but they can do that. And correct me if I'm wrong, you can sit with your entire net worth that's in cash and sit on the corner and write everybody that walks by a check for $13,000 until you run out of money and you don't run into trouble with the IRS. Is that true?
That's correct. And if you're married, the two of you can double. It's
$26,000. Oh, man. I want to find somebody like that on the corner, but you're not going to find anybody like that on the corner because it's usually going to go to families or your friends.
Well, you know, grandparents, if we have any grandparents out there who want to help their grandchildren's college education, they can gift a nice amount of money to the college savings programs, the so-called 529 plans, and they actually can put more than $13,000 in there in 1 year. They can actually front load it, so to speak, as much as I think $65,000, if I remember correctly, and they help their grandchildren. It could either be for the college savings programs or for the so-called prepaid plans, in which they could give their grandchildren the gift of education, since we're talking about gifts here.
Okay. Let's go back to deductions now, and we'll talk about something called a standard deduction. Thus far, we've been talking about what you can deduct. Mortgage interest, you can do this, you can do that. But there are people maybe later on in life, close to retirement, a little bit into retirement, where the mortgage is maybe not what it once was. And that might be the bigger part of their itemized deductions, unless they live in a high state income tax area. Then their deductions aren't as much as what's called a standard deduction. So what the IRS says is, listen, instead of asking you to sit with your shoebox and figuring out how much you gave here, how much you spent there, we can just give you a flat amount. And for 2011, married filing joint folks can claim a standard deduction without any itemized deductions of $11,600 and $8,500 for head of households and $5,800 for singles. So, again, correct me if I'm wrong, a married filing joint or a head of household or a single, based on the numbers we just did, could just say, listen, I don't think I have it. I don't want to spend forever finding out that I don't have it. I can just claim this flat amount. And they can do that, huh?
That's right. I mean, like you mentioned, Bob, they don't want to go through the shoeboxes because you cannot legally really itemize unless you have the records to support your itemized deductions. Well, maybe you don't have the records. So the next best thing is take the standard deduction. It'll make your return so much easier, less hassle, and you may end up paying a little more tax, but the fact of the matter is you get to get your taxes done in the most efficient and best way.
All right. And if you're on the border of this, what you might consider doing is itemizing every other year. Claim the standard deduction in one, pay less in state income tax or local real estate taxes. Now, you might pay a penalty to do this, but the penalty will be far less than what the tax savings would be, especially if these things are due towards the end of the year. And you kind of like double up every other year. And then every other year you would go substantially over the standard, save it whatever your bracket is, and then you'd come down. Same thing might hold true for the taxation of Social Security because it's Well, let me back off on that, because Social Security really doesn't have anything to do with itemized deductions. It has more to do with gross income. Ed is looking at me like I have two heads. All right, so I backed off of that.
I just want to mention, Bob, there are many employees out there who may not have a lot of, they don't have just a lot of itemized deductions. They don't own a house. They don't pay mortgage interest. They don't have property tax, and they're saying, gee, I got to take the standard deduction. Is there anything that I can do to lessen my taxes? Are there any breaks out there? Well, there are a few. Let me just bring one that comes to mind. I teach new employee seminars, and a lot of these new employees are fresh out of college. They have a whole bunch of student loans to pay back. And the interest that is paid on that loan, I think up to $2,500 in a given year, the interest is considered to be, that you pay can be a, is an adjustment to one's income.
Now, what's an adjustment again?
Those are my favorite, Bob. They come off an adjustment to your income is deducted from your gross income in computing your taxable income. It's from your adjusted gross income, that is your gross income minus adjustments income, that we deduct personal exemptions and the standard deduction or itemized deductions. I just want to give a word of caution. A lot of these adjustments to income, such as student interest deductions, such as traditional IRA contributions, are sensitive to one's adjusted gross income. If your adjusted gross income is too high, then you cannot take the adjustment to your income. But most people who cannot itemize, chances are their AGI is low enough that they will be eligible for these, to take these adjustments to their income to reduce their taxes.
Okay, thanks, Ed. And the ability to put money into an IRA, the maximum in 2012 is probably not going to be any different than it was in 2000. Not probably, it isn't going to be. The amount, as you so accurately put, that you can put into the TSP is going to go up 500, but the catch-up for those, what's the age for a catch-up?
50 or older as of the end of the year.
Okay, that's going to remain at 5,000.
Still,
that's a significant amount of money going out of one's pocket.
That makes people over the age of 50 or older can put $6,000 into an IRA. Those younger than 50 can put in 5,000. One other adjustment to income I want to mention, Bob, that a lot of people are not aware of. When one contributes to a health savings account, HSA, not an FSA. FSA is a flexible spending account. This is a health savings account. To have a health savings account, you have to be to contribute to a health savings account, you have to be enrolled in a high deductible health insurance plan. And when you put money into the HSA, the money you put in is considered to be an adjustment to your income. How much can you contribute to an HSA for 2011? The most you can put in, if yourself is if you're self only, single person, is $3,100. If you have a self and family health insurance plan, the most the family can put in is a total of $6,200. The good thing about the HSA is the fact that, unlike the healthcare FSA, in which there's a use or lose situation by March 15th of every year, the following year, following the plan year, you can carry over money in an HSA from one year to the next. And the contributions you make are going to be considered to be an adjustment to your income with no AGI limitation, like there is with the deductible IRA.
Pretty neat. Now, you're a smart guy, and I know you know this, but next week we start the open season shows, and we run it through the end of open season. And next week, Kaiser Permanente, John Patrick, and John always brings a physician with him and maybe a manager type or marketing type. It's a very good show, but that'll kick off. But Ed laid out some framework for this HSA health savings account, but you have to have a high deductible health care plan. What's the alphabet soup there? HSA has to have a
high deductible health. You have to be enrolled in a high deductible health insurance plan.
And that, the acronym for that is
HDHP, high deductible health plan.
Because when we get going next week, I'm going to need to call you up.
Put money into a health savings account, HSA, health savings account.
Okay, that's good. Now, we're running up against the clock. We've got a couple minutes, but I'd like to hit the taxation of Social Security, because people just kind of scratch their heads. Generally, but not always, it's not taxable at the state level. So let's do the easy one first. But at the federal level, it could be taxable at three different levels. For our listening audience, whether currently employed or whether they're going to retire and receive Social Security, you can pretty much forget the first, the 0% taxation, because your income has to be really low. Maybe the next one, where if you go into the next one, if your income is still pretty low, maybe in retirement, you would pay tax on half the Social Security. And if your income is above this modest amount, then you could pay tax on 85% of it. No one should mishear that. That has to be included in your income. It's not an 85% tax. So if you receive $10,000 in Social Security, 15% is non-taxable. That's the way to look at it. And $8,500 would show up on your return. Is that the way it works?
That's correct, Bob. And I want to point out that these three levels of tax, which you mentioned, the brackets for that have not changed in 28 years.
Yeah.
They came out in 1983, these three bracket levels. And since then, they have not changed, and I think we've had a little inflation since that time. But Congress has not raised the brackets, meaning with the bottom line is most people now who are on Social Security are probably paying their Social Security benefits. 85% of their Social Security benefits will be subject to federal tax. I want to point out that there are a handful of states that tax Social Security like the federal government. So people have to be aware and talk about it. People ask me, what are the good states to retire to? Well, don't look just at income taxes. Look at all taxes.
Okay, well, we're going to have to go into semi-retirement for a week here. So final comments, Ed?
Do planning now. Make moves now to cut down your taxes between now and December 31st. Don't wait till January or February.
And listen to next week's show with Kaiser Permanente, John Patrick, and his entourage. Thanks for listening. Talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. The show can also be heard 24/7 on federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for listening.